Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today's guest is American grandmaster Robert Hess. Robert is a former U.S. junior champion. He became a grandmaster in 2009 at the age of 17, and he reached a peak rating of 2639 in 2012. Robert has represented the United States at various Olympiads, both as a player and as a captain of both the women's and the open team. Not many people can say that. But most of you will probably know Robert Hess as one of the star commentators of chess.com and as a popular streamer. I hope we will speak about his commentating too, but the original reason why I invited Robert to appear on the New in Chess podcast is a book written by his former coach Miron Cher entitled Dream Moves, Eye-Opening Chess Lessons for Improvers. That was published by New in Chess. Miron Cher died 4 years ago, so this book appears posthumously, and the main mover behind that laudable project was Robert. Robert, hello. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well, Dirk-Jan. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's really an honor to be here.
The first line of your preface to Dream Moves reads, I wouldn't be where and who I am without Miron Cher. That's an unambiguous statement. Can you say something more about that?
Yeah, no. Miron Cher was my chess coach, my one and only chess coach. I never worked with anyone besides him. And he was not just a coach, but a true mentor. The way he cared about not just me, but all of his students, it was profound, it was deep, it was reflected in just every single thing that he did. So when I say that I wouldn't be who or where I am without Miron, it is 100% the truth. And he's had a lasting and a forever long impact on my life.
Yeah. How would you introduce him as a person to people who, well, have not met him? What kind of person was he? What was the work that he was doing?
Extraordinarily selfless is how I'd first and foremost describe him, because Miron, he always put the student first. Not just the student as a chess player, but the student as a human being. The amount of sacrifice that he would put in for all of his students, whether it was telling them, you know, I'm not going to coach you anymore, even though I think that's, you know, that hurt me because I want to work with you, unless you improve this part of yourself, because I think that will be beneficial for your life. Whether it was coming to my family's home the day after September 11th, just to make a sense of normalcy for myself as a child. There's countless examples, and I mean, it really brings me nearly to tears to talk about him sometimes, just because of how much he meant to me and my entire family.
How old were you when you started working with him, and how did that come about?
Well, I was really young. I was about 7 years old. I had just been picking up chess. My dad taught me and my siblings. And Miron was a coach at the after-school program. And I just knew that this was my coach. Like, I don't remember this fully. I was so young. But from what my parents tell me is, I came home and I was like, that's the person I want to learn chess from. And then when he first came to my home, you know, his English at that time was not as fluent as it became. And my parents, they struggled a bit to understand him, but everything that he was saying chess-wise, he and I connected. And we just had this connection from the first day we worked together all throughout our working relationship.
And these would be weekly lessons? How would that go? I mean, or several sessions? How often did you see him?
It fluctuated because early on, it was a couple times a week. Then there were summers where we wouldn't actually see each other pretty much at all. But this is funny. He would send postcards. Yeah, this is how long we were working together. Postcards with chess positions on them. And my responsibility would be to fill them out with the answers and then send them back to him. So, we had a method, even when we were apart, to still, you know, be able to learn, to work together. And, you know, when I got to middle school and started, hanging out on weekends with friends, I said, I don't want to have lessons twice a weekend or anything like that. Maybe just once a week would be good. And he was immediately receptive. And you know, he still helped me become the player that I did, despite a scale back, because that's what I wanted.
In the introduction to the book, Miron Cher, he writes about the various players that he worked with. And they are people like Sumbat Laputian, the Armenian grandmaster. That was new to me. Peter Heine Nielsen, the trainer of Magnus Carlsen. Fabiano Caruana and you. And he approached you as the different players that you were. Was that the special gift that he had?
That indeed was special about Miron. And he used to tell me that for a 2-hour lesson, there were times he'd prepare over 4 hours just for that one lesson. And wow. I could tell. Like, as now that I'm older, when I was younger, I probably just said, all right, people say things to embellish, to make it sound like they're working extra hard. But in all seriousness, now that I'm older, I really could tell the amount of care and work he would put in. And there's a reason we all played. Well, I don't know about some of the players that he worked with before he and I worked together, but you know, with Fabiano or with a lot of his other students, we played different openings. And the amount of work it takes to prepare people in each and every opening, obviously that's not a job done lightly. So yeah, it was always catered to the individual, and that's something that I've taken with me to this day.
But then probably he would also detect weaknesses in your play and want to work on those. Were there weaknesses that he discovered that you thought, well, how did you spot that? Because, well, sometimes you try to cover your weaknesses, but a coach sees that.
Yeah, he pretty much saw everything. It's funny because my weakness is glaringly obvious. It's that my openings are not great. And he knew that I did not like openings. And you know, if we're honest, many people don't like sitting and trying to memorize opening theory, but it is very important. It's not about memorization. And that's what he helped instill in me after a while, is that at first I thought, okay, I just have to memorize this stuff. That's not why I love chess. I love the creativity, the coming up with ideas in the spur of the moment while you're seated at the board. But to me, openings were prepared in advance. So that felt like that these were at odds with one another. And the way Miron taught me opening was pretty much freestyle. You can be in charge of what you play. And there were certain openings that, of course, I went with, whether it was the Pirtz early on, which, I mean, I don't know how many kids are playing the Pirtz, but the Alapin Sicilian is what I went with. And then the Close Sicilian, all sorts of what would be considered offbeat openings at the highest level. He let me roll with them because he understood that's actually what I enjoyed. And it helped me for sure become the player that I did.
But these were openings that you selected and he allowed you to play them, or were they selected by him?
He is not somebody who would say, you're going to play this. I mean, he was way too kind-hearted for that. But he also understood that chess players, you know, very often they shouldn't be dictated to. Right? Like, you do this now is not going to be a recipe for success. So Miron would collaborate with me. Sometimes we'd actually play. Like, we would sit during lessons and just like look at a game and maybe play the opening out. And for most of our working relationship, he was the stronger player, but it was never about winning or losing. It was about, what does Robert see when he plays this opening? If he's playing a mainline Nydorf, what's his reaction? And that sort of intuitive feel I found is so important when you're working with chess players, because yes, you could teach them the latest and greatest that Fabiano and Anish and Hikaru and Magnus, etc., have come up with, but they're not going to play exactly like them because, well, one, there's a strength issue, but more importantly, there's a personality type attached. Do you actually like this position that you're coming across? And that is really of the utmost importance.
Well, he comes across as a very thoughtful and sensitive person. What I liked, what he described in his introduction, is that he says, well, actually, the first rule for a trainer should be similar to the first, to part of the Hippocratic Oath. First, try not to do any harm to the player. That sounds very wise.
Yeah, you know, it actually nearly brings me to tears because, I reflect on one of my fondest moments of Miron. Actually came in a time where of deep upset. It was a World Youth Tournament. It was the last round. I lost the game, and I was like, 11 years old, 12 years old. I don't remember the exact occasion, but I took it out on him. Not in a way, I was a young kid, so I wasn't saying anything mean, but I just was crying and I was upset and I blamed him.
Yeah.
And he swallowed that blame. And he said, you're right, like, we should have looked at this. Of course, when I looked at my files a little bit later, everything that needed to be discussed had been discussed, was in the notebook, in the files. Mm. But I was a young kid and he realized at that time that instead of being correct of what actually transpired, it was more important to be supportive. And kids grow. I've become an adult. And I know that, you know, of course, at that moment, if we look at all the facts, I was not correct in blaming him because it was my fault. It was my lapse. But at that time, that's what I needed. So the do no harm mantra from Miron is 1,000,000% true. And I can just think of countless examples of where he prioritized myself and other people. And that's why I use the word selfless, because it was almost entirely ahead of himself. There's nothing more important to Miron. Number one was his family. That is, I mean, just absolutely clear. And then I would say after that were his students and his chess family.
But how would you describe that? I say well, his family came first. In what way did you feel that as a pupil, or was it just something that you saw how much they meant to him? Or, I mean, can you say something about that?
Well, I spent enough time with him traveling to tournaments where I, you know, could overhear some of the phone calls. And so there's a bit of a personal touch to it. I mean, we did travel together to events, and he worked as my coach / second. But also just in the way he spoke about chess, the way he just spoke about life. I mean, of course, he was way more than just a coach to me. We talked about so many things, and he would just inject little stories that involved Alla and Mikhail. And so there would never be a lesson where their names weren't mentioned. And I think that just goes to show you know, how near and dear to his heart and to his mind they always were, where it felt like there'd be an Alla, you know, reference about how he and Alla went to this tournament and this happened. Or, you know, how Mikhail...
And Alla is his wife, and she's also a chess player. So.
Very strong player. Yeah, she is. And they both were professional players, and she remains a coach. And Mikhail... It doesn't play chess professionally, but also a very strong chess player. So family was really near and dear to his heart, as I said, and that was abundantly clear.
Yeah. Well, you traveled to tournaments together. There was an age difference of, well, close to 40 years. How did he turn that not into a problem? I mean, how did he make you feel comfortable and make you feel that this was a normal thing?
You know what's funny about the chess world is that you see 8-year-olds play against 80-year-olds. Right? That's one of the joys of chess, is that really it spans continents and generations, and you name it, everyone is playing chess. But I think Miron, just his friendliness in general, like, it was obvious that we were very different ages and generations, and also backgrounds, right? I was born and raised in New York City, and Miron was raised in the Soviet Union, and he came to New York, right? So those were learning opportunities for me. I mean, we had serious conversations about what it was like for him growing up, from his background, how he could succeed as a chess player and then ultimately as a coach. So these were not ignored. These were not swept under the rug. These were talked about. And I think Miron treated me like I was somebody who he could speak to about these things. Of course, when I was really young, things would be above my knowledge base. So it's not like I could understand the nuances of the Soviet Union and who was allowed to play in tournaments and who wasn't. But he did speak to me like I was a mature individual who could process the information, and that it would be a continuing learning experience.
Do you think that's an essential part of the role that a coach has to play, that he also instills life lessons, that it shouldn't be only about chess? Is that an essential part?
Yeah, because when I think about the preparation that we did, sometimes it was taking long walks before a match. You would think that, oh, you're just at the computer, you're going over every single opening line. He actually believed there were times where, throw that away, let's reset, refresh ourselves, go for a long walk, and we weren't even really talking about chess. So, Miron, like I said, I can't speak for everybody else that he worked with, but I know with me, he understood that there were times where the chess wasn't the problem. It was getting in the right mindset, or maybe separating yourself from the chess a little bit so that you could approach the next game as if it were new, instead of a continuation of the preparation and all that's running through your mind.
Did you feel that there was some general life wisdom in him, which, well, must have come from the drastic change in his life when he moved to the United States? I mean, he was from the Soviet Union, from the Ukrainian part, and came to the United States. I mean, those first years, they must have been pretty complicated. Did he speak about that?
it's very Miron to not speak about the difficulties that he experienced. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's that he didn't want to burden other people with what he perceived as his specific problems. So it was never really painted in that kind of way. But Miron worked super hard. Like, he woke up really early. He would come home late at night often from lessons. And he was a professional chess coach. And I want to emphasize the word professional. The amount of work that he put in each and every day to get through his assortment of students, it just is incredible. And for Miron, yeah, I don't really think he tried to dwell in the negative. I think he didn't want to put that on other people. And that's why I keep returning to the word selfless. It's like, I, of course, wanted to learn about Miron as a person, and no person is free of negative experiences. And he did talk to me about some of them, but for the most part, he kept things, I would say, upbeat and cheery, and he tried to make it a positive atmosphere.
Which must have been difficult at times, because I think when so many former Soviets came to America, I mean, they were not always welcomed with open arms, because they were taking some people's places. Did you feel that this was something that he had to fight as well?
For sure. And there were definitely times where I felt like I had to stand up for him, because people would be a bit critical of what they maybe perceived as broken English or things like that. Miron spoke great English. Like, this wasn't an issue that people should have been harping on. And most importantly, he was a very sweet, kind, you know, caring person. So to make that a focal point, and you hear these things, right? And it's not to say that everybody had a problem, because that's definitely not true. He worked very closely with David McAnulty and the Dalton staff. He had many extremely close coworkers and friends from his experience. But there were definitely times where you just heard people say things. But on the flip side, one of the best experiences I had with Miron was when we went to the Moscow Open. Mm. The amount of people who came up to me, who I didn't even know personally, I'd only known of them, and were just telling me how amazing it was that I got to work with Miron. And I'm talking about well-established Soviet, you know, Union era grandmasters who they said, "Can Miron, is it okay if we take him aside?" Because there were instructor lessons like help teach teachers how to work. And Miron was working with me at this tournament, but he was also actually doing these panels and talks. And he thought it was just going to be one, you know, friend asked him, but it was multiple, and everybody wanted to hear his thoughts. And to me, that was so awesome, because this was a humble man who, as we're talking about, he, you know, was an immigrant in the United States, where people sometimes kind of picked on the fact that he wasn't from that place. And just hear people uniformly praise him, I think that was one of the happiest moments of my working relationship with him, but of my life. Like, just to see somebody like that receive their praise and their laurels, it was truly awesome.
But also a confirmation that you had a really, really great coach who had also been a strong player. I think it was Mikhail Chishin who said at some point, I mean, his bad luck as a player was that he was of the generation of Belyavsky and others, a very strong generation. So even if you were a very strong grandmaster then in the Soviet Union, that didn't automatically mean that, well, you would be a prominent player.
Well, selfishly, in a way, I'm glad that the playing career stopped and the coaching career started, because I wouldn't have met him, at least not on the terms that we did. But that, I think that is true. But Miron himself, he would show me occasion games, and I had to get it out of him. Because at some point, I think when I was 22, 2300, something like that, I was like, man, I don't think I've ever seen a game of yours. Like, I can go in the database, and I
that's
can
funny,
research
that
it on my
never,
own.
He never had never. Shown you any. That's amazing.
Never. Yeah. And I think that's true to his personality, is he didn't want to make it about himself. He didn't want to, you know, show his own games. And he has a book now, right? We see how many examples. He was always looking at the major events, finding good resources to use. So he probably felt he didn't need his own games. But he had some awesome, there's a bishop endgame where his bishop goes into H1. And I remember that was the first time I saw a game of his. And I was like, Miron, you kind of got it.
Yeah. Well, in, let's say in the chess world, we always have this fascination with the Soviet school of chess or the Russian school of chess as something mythical, something mystic. Was that part of your fascination with him, that you think, okay, there's someone coming from the chess planet and he knows all the secrets, and I have the privilege of being trained by him? What's that feeling there?
I don't know if it was that deep initially. I don't recall because I was so young, but I think we just bonded. And what he always said to my parents is he saw a hunger when I played, that he saw that I gave, he would say all the way through his life that one of, if not my greatest attribute as a chess player was that I gave 10,000%. And so we would play the instructors and they would give queen odds because the instructors were strong and we were beginners. And I would go again. Like, I would lose, and then I would say, again, and he would watch me play, and he would see that I was actually making progress, despite the fact nobody was really informing me how to play without a with my opponent without having a queen. And so I think he just recognized in me a potential that there's no way I could have recognized in myself, and I highly doubt my parents could have, because with all love and respect, I'm very close with my parents. My mom, she's a beginner. My dad probably was around 1,200. Let's say, so he can play, but he couldn't recognize perhaps that instinct or that that trait to become good. And I think we see that in people. We don't know if it's true, but that's what Miron, he latched onto. He said, there is something here. And even in our first year of training together, you can look at my rating history. I think I stayed about the same in US chess rating, but he was absolutely persistent and consistent saying, watch. He's there. He doesn't show the results right now, but he has it. And then I went on from there and gained a ton of rating. And I think he felt fully justified.
Yeah. Well, there's the book now. And well, we can safely say that, in fact, it was because of you. Because at some point, you asked him, where do you get all these fantastic games? Where do all these brilliant examples come from? And he promised you, he said, well, one day I'll write that book, because these were all his files that he had. So how did the book come about? I mean, after he died, there were these manuscripts, and you thought, well, this has to be a book.
Well, I can't take credit for the book itself. Mm. I think, you know, what we're talking about, when he never showed me examples of his own games, where did all this come from? The amount of work that he put in, but for many years, for decades, he had books that he himself would write positions in, write analysis. Like, these are his own personal files. And I did ask him that question, and perhaps that inspired him to say, you know, when you become a grandmaster, I'll make this book. And you know, thankfully it happened sooner than he thought. But you know, he is solely responsible alongside his family. I do want to give so much credit to his wife, Ala, and son, Mikhail, because they put everything together. They translated it, because a lot of his writings were in Russian. That's his native language. And then they were able to put everything together. And there's so much more than even one book can hold. But that's who Miron was. And that, like I said, it's the family that he always had, is that such a close-knit, you know, care for each other, make sure that this could become a finished product that could go into a book form. And I mean, I'm just so pleased that it's there. And you could see it, Dirk-Jan. I don't know if our listeners will be able to, but you know, it nearly brings tears to my eyes, because you know, this book is so much more than just a book. You know, this is the life's work, and just a part of it, of one of the kindest, hardest working people that you could ever meet. And also, the samples that he puts in here, the examples, excuse me, they're what I did. This is how I became a better player.
Yeah, you recognize many of them.
Yeah, you know, I have the book right here.
Yeah.
And I remembered, you know, when I first opened it and I was like, I 100% have seen this one and this other example from like 1981 that was definitely on one of the postcards that he sent to me when we were away for the summer. So it brings that back some very happy memories as I get to reminisce about my failures trying to solve them the first time.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, these postcards, you had to send them back, or did you send back other postcards? I mean, did you keep the originals?
So I would send them back, but essentially it would be a postcard with six positions on it.
Yeah.
And either I would write back a letter with my answers to said positions, or right underneath the positions, there was a little bit of room.
Yeah.
But that allowed me to be my lazy self and write, you know, one move answers, which are completely unacceptable in the Miron Cher school of chess.
Yeah.
So I want to point out that, you know, guessing the first move, so to speak, that's not the correct answer. It's always... about the why.
It was one of the things that I liked in the book. I mean, there were many of those ideas that you think, oh yeah, this is a great idea. So don't give me the first move of the solution. Give me the last move of the solution, because then I know that you really got the solution.
And he used to do that in group lessons, because that allowed everybody to tackle the position when there were players of different strengths. If someone just says the first move, it ruins it for everybody. But if you say the last move, that makes it much more challenging. That could be the fifth move of the variation. And I always appreciated when Miran would do that with me, is if I would say a one move or two move answer because I knew the answer, he would say, what's the last move of this puzzle? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, what's the final move? And that really forced me to dig deeper, to think longer and harder about the positions, like you would as if you were sitting at the board.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the book. It's a thematic improvement book. There are five chapters with five different themes. And the title of the book, Dream Moves, that's one of the themes. And it's actually something that he thought up himself, this idea. Maybe you can say something about it, because I think it's one of those ideas in chess that you hear them once and you'll never forget them.
And it's something that I use in my commentary to this day, where the concept of dream moves could be you have a bishop on the long dark square diagonal. So what do you need? You need to get a queen in the corner. So that's your dream move, is queen over and out to g7 or h8 with checkmate, and that's the end of the game. So there would be positions where you would see the outline, the skeleton of a checkmating net, but how do you actually make it work? And if I may, one of my favorite things that Miran did, which I didn't appreciate when I was young, is he would trick me. And you say, what do you mean he would trick you? Like, what? That's a bad thing. That sounds negative. Yeah. No, because we assume things sometimes as chess players, and it is bad to assume. You need to calculate. You need to figure it out on your own rather than assuming that it exists. So if there would be a position that, say, there's a whole chapter on the 20% rule, so you think, oh, I'm going to push this pawn. But sometimes that would not be the correct answer. But he would sort of lead you to believe that it was, to say, and he would say this. This is a direct quote. He said, do not believe me. Believe your brain. So he was a strong grandmaster, a renowned trainer. So if he is saying something, of course I probably should believe most of what he's saying. But there were times where he would make it so that I'm not just listening and shaking my head yes. I'm calculating. So I'd be like, wait, Miran, are you sure about that? That's not. He goes, good job. And there were lessons where that was almost the running joke, the theme of the lesson, where instead of it just being, he is going to espouse wisdom and teach me things, it was, he would say things, some of which were intentionally not correct, to make sure that I was actually taking it in, processing, and not just like in one ear, okay, now I'm just going to, believe everything you say. Because just like I shouldn't believe everything he was saying, you shouldn't believe everything your opponent is doing at the chessboard. And I think that's especially true for newer players, where they say, oh, I blunder a lot, but they don't recognize that their opponents blunder. Because sometimes we all make mistakes. And so instead of just assuming that every move is proper by your opponent, look out. There may be a mistake made along the way. And just a recent example was in Norway chess when I saw Pia Kramling and Juwon Jun playing. It was an end game. It should have been a draw. And then there was that mistake for one turn that Pia recognized only after she traded the rooks. And you could see on her face, like, oh, the horror. And these things happen to everybody, so it's not to single anyone out. But it's one of those moments where I'm like, this is what the kind of thing Miran would do in lessons. Say, oh, it's just an easy draw, trade of the rooks. And then you pause and be like, wait, what about that knight check to distract the opponent's knight? Can that be played? So I think moments like that are some of the most instructive moments that a chess player can come across.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the 20% rule, which indeed is something that is, very memorable, easy to remember as well. He has based it on the Pareto principle, which I must confess, I didn't know it was called that way, but it is that 80% of the results are generated by 20% of the efforts. And he applies the rule to positions where a pawn has advanced to the fifth or sixth rank. And he says, well, in those cases, in 20% of the cases, pushing it further will be the correct solution. How important is such a rule?
Extremely. Because when I would play and when I still do play chess, when I have a pawn that's, you know, approaching the other side, yeah, I will always consider that pawn push.
Yeah.
And it's something that he instilled in me, saying it's not always going to be correct, but it's always incorrect to not consider it. So the point is that you should always be thinking about, does it work? Because you want passed pawns in chess. You want to get a queen. And also passed pawns help you attack. Not just passed pawns, excuse me, far advanced pawns. So I think that it really did help me. It's like a heuristic that helped me think about positions, that I had that 20% rule in my head. I still have it in my head. I can still hear his voice telling me, you know, about it. And then also telling me, I got you. You know, this is not one of the 20% rule positions, but you're tempted to believe it is because of things you've learned. And this is the case of learning from him, but things you learn from anybody, you just kind of rely on that sometimes rather than going back to what we're talking about. We're going to your brain, to your calculation, and to trusting yourself.
How important is it to put a tag on something, an idea like this? Is it part of the systematic way of thinking that every chess player needs? I mean, here we have the 20% rule. Here is the dream move. I mean, to me, it sounds very logical that you should have these tags.
I think it's what made him such a great coach, is that he allowed it in a way that many people, if not everyone, could understand. Right? These are memorable slogans. The dream move, because of course I think about that. I almost dream of it now, where it's like, where does my piece belong? How am I going to orchestrate that plan? And so some of the chapters, like the unprotected piece, that's something that everybody knows about, but the examples are fantastic. But these are concepts that are going to be familiar to most chess players who have been learning the game. Whereas the 20% rule, I think that was new for a lot of even strong players and instructors. They thought this is a great way to teach people how to advance their pawns, because you hear about this concept, but you don't know to apply it. The when and the why is what's at the core.
Yeah. Well, what I like is that there's a big number of exercises, and what he does is, well, first he lures you with all these beautiful examples, and you get to love the idea. Then you get the examples, they start the exercises, and they start from very simple to complicated, so that you have this repetitive idea of returning to a theme once you are getting better. Seems to be a lot of logic in that.
Yeah, there is, and it's how he trained me. I remember the puzzles. If you think there are a lot of puzzles in here, I can't even count the number of puzzles that he gave me throughout my growth as a chess player. Yeah. But you know, I would get, say, 18 puzzles to do in the week, and that at first I was like, oh, I do so many puzzles online. These were hard puzzles, like above my level probably, where I was just sitting and thinking and spending hours doing these puzzles. And they would have sometimes a common theme that I wouldn't even recognize. And then he would ask me, so what did you notice about the positions? And I'm like, what do you mean what I noticed? They were really hard, and I probably got, you know, 8 out of 18 correct. So I feel like I'm not good enough right now. He's like, no, but if you look at the positions, there's the 20% rule theme in these few. There's a dream move concept in these. Here's an opposite color bishops where, you know, this one over here is a draw and that one over here actually is not a draw. So he's just pulling out different themes that are very useful, because you didn't start kind of compiling a mental database of ideas that I did store in the memory bank.
Yeah. And, well, you said he had these notebooks. Were they uniform notebooks, or was it rather random that there were notebooks and loose files or whatever? How systematic was it?
Knowing Miron, it was incredibly systematic. I think that, of course, sometimes people pen ideas, and there's that. We have to remind ourselves that when Miron was a player and when he was really competitive, this was in the pre-engine era. Yeah. So whatever opening ideas, you know, whatever concepts that he was coming up with, they were not engine approved and you could just store online, that you could just quickly save. So he had notebooks full of ideas from when he was playing, when he was also working as a coach, even back in the Soviet Union. And then with positions, I do think that he would organize them. I actually didn't really get to see inside the notebooks. That was part of the mystery of the coaching, is like he would have these notebooks, he would have ideas, and to this day, I couldn't really tell you what was inside, but I could tell you what was inside my notebooks, because I used to have a notebook. It had a purple outside, what's it called? Like a graph paper on the inside that you use in math class. And I would annotate my games move by move, and in the notation would be in the left-hand side, and the right-hand column, I would write what I was thinking at the time. So it could be one E4, one E5, this is my first move. Like, whatever. Yeah, most of it, that kind of stuff you'd have to fill in. But later it would be like, I was out of my knowledge of the opening, so this move felt sensible to me to develop my bishop and so on. So that actually was part of my training, was dissecting the why of what I was doing. And I know it. I could go on forever about this, but it was truly, foundational to how I approach the game of chess, is the why behind the moves that we make.
Yeah. Well, I think people today would be amazed to see how systematic these notebooks were that they had in Soviet times. And I mean, everyone was doing it, and they had regular handwriting, and some of them, they're just pieces of art. And it's funny, as we're talking, I remember that we once got, I mean, when he just was breaking through, Vladimir Kramnik, he sent us two of those notebooks to New in Chess. And he said, well, I'm a young master from Russia, and these are some of my ideas of openings, and maybe you can use them in your magazine or your books, but then please send me a subscription. And years later, I took one of those notebooks to Kramnik, and I said, I mean, this was written by you, wasn't it? I said, just some silly thing. Can you confirm that you wrote this and just put it in writing? And then Vladimir, he wrote, he says, yes, this is what I wrote as a kid. And I asked for a subscription, and of course, I never got it. Of course, later he did get it, but at that point. But it's so amazing to see all these notebooks. Yeah,
and that was the era.
Yeah, and as far as I understand, there's still many, well, several other notebooks that have material enough for a next book. That certainly would be a good idea. And I can say that for this book, that we have a special promo code that can be found on our website, where people who, if they are interested in the book, they can get a 20% discount on the book when they order it.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
What I wanted to ask you, Robert, I mean, you're very active as a commentator, and you already refer to it yourself, that there's things of the things that you learned from Miron Cher that you use in your commentary. Well, you can say that commentating on the game is also educating an audience, explaining to an audience, so that there inevitably must be aspects of a trainer in there. How often does it happen that you use things that take you back in your memory to those days?
All the time. Yeah. It's not always active and conscious, but there are definitely moments where I end a show and I think back to something I said, and I was like, that was Miron. Like, that is what Miron instilled in me, and I'm able to use my voice and help other people learn. And what's great about it is there are some concepts and some phrases that I have that I've come up with, but I feel like somewhere Miron is proud of me for that. Like, I truly think, like, he would be so proud to think he has come up with a way to articulate certain ideas where, for example, I like to say a pawn chain is always as strong as its base pawn in the chain. And that's why you want to hammer away and make the pawn chain shorter. And that's probably, someone's said it before, I don't want to take credit for it. But things like that where I'm just like, I don't remember Miron ever saying that, and I'm sure other people have. But I just feel after day of commentary where I'm trying to help people learn, and that's always key to me, is I've had to change as a commentator where I think initially you just want to analyze positions for yourself and for your other co-commentator. But you need to realize that the audience out there, they're not going to be at the grandmaster level. And so how do we actually approach the game that is inclusive of other people? And that's what Miron was all about. And so, when I commentate, I use dream moves myself, and I give him full credit because it's he's the one who taught me that concept. And the 20% rule, that's Mehran's bread and butter. And so there are many different ideas that I have, ones that I've formulated on my own, that I still think back of, like, where did I even come up with this from? And I think Mehran, as I said in the foreword to the book, like, he has had such an important role in my life that you never give anyone 100% credit for everything you do. But I would be dishonest if I didn't say that he had such a tremendous impact on me that likely the chess things that I come up with, I mean, I was a little kid when I started playing, and he was my one and only coach. He taught me everything that I know about the game. So of course I pay my respect to him in that way, whereas he was a brilliant, brilliant teacher.
Yeah. Well, there's an awful lot of beauty in these concepts or these general ideas. It's some sort of a poetry that it's not, maybe not 100% true, but doesn't matter. I mean, it evokes an idea that is clear to everyone and gives you an insight in what a position is about. So I think their value is immense.
Yeah, and I think that the training, that Soviet era training, where he would give me a lot of Karpov games, right? He would show me, and there's a slow build, and suddenly you see a knight retreat back from c3 to b1, and then eventually it gets a dream move in, right? It's like, what's the dream move for this knight? All the way on the other side of the board for an attack later in the game. Yeah. And that kind of Karpovian lesson, I think that those things have really stuck with me, where oftentimes we want the immediate gratification. We want that checkmate. But sometimes it's a backwards move. We know retreating moves are some of the hardest to spot in chess. Yeah. But what piece can we improve? What's its ideal square? How do we make that dream move happen?
Yeah. Well, we are already talking about commentating. And, we started out on the book by Mehran Cher. But, of course, I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't ask you some questions about your commentating, because you're commentating an awful lot and at very prestigious events, and you're rightly very, very popular. There is such a wide variety of events that you comment on. Are there any favorites?
Ooh. I mean,
tricky.
I wasn't expecting that question. No. I came mentally prepared for most, Dirk-Jan, but that one. No. Okay, my favorite, so the Speed Chess Championship, I love. It's chaos, it's exciting, you know, it's going to be difficult to follow, especially in the bullet portions, and it's very hard to commentate on, but I just love the head-to-head nature of it, hours-long matches where we usually get Magnus versus Hikaru at the end, but perhaps somebody will eliminate them, Maxime has done in the past, so I love the Speed Chess Championship, but I also love events like Vikingze. I think it just starts the year right. And classical chess, it does get a lot of criticism. I do think some events, the time control can be shortened. I won't deny that. But I love Vikingze. I love the tournament itself. I love the invitations. I think that it provides such a great atmosphere of fighting chess. And, you know, we get the end of the year, the World Rapid and Blitz, which is also a lovely event. And then we get the people saying, this is what it's all about. Yeah. And then quickly, I think, this tournament in, if I could say, the Tata Steel tournament, the festival. It's not just a tournament, it's a whole festival. I've been there on a number of occasions commentating. It's so lovely. I do think it sets the right tone for the year. And then I would say, I mean, there are many events that are great, but I think if I had to pick just two, those two definitely stand out near the top.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's also the variety that because the challenges are totally different, which keeps it interesting for you. I mean, sometimes I long to write for a general newspaper and just to try to explain, the beauty of chess to a layman's audience. And the other, at another moment, I mean, it's the variety that can be. I can imagine that even, also things like PogChamps, that it's so different that it becomes interesting.
That's for sure. Variety is the spice of life, as they say. And I think what is the theme, that's something that I enjoy, that for people of all levels, is that you can always learn something from a game of chess. And it's what I hope to put out to the world in my commentary, is that if you learn one thing, just even one, I think that's a fun experience. I know I love learning. And if I can learn something new every day, I kind of consider that a successful day.
Yeah. What is the toughest? Because I remember, I was speaking to you on a previous occasion, and you said, well, I don't know, because I'm very busy, because I think you had to comment on Bullet for a couple of hours. And I thought, that sounds really tough. I mean, how much fun is that?
It's fun. Once I take off my chess player hat, it's very fun. Because you can't really analyze what's happening at Bullet because the moves are coming in so quickly. So I would say Bullet is difficult in one way. The World Championship is actually very difficult in another. Because there may be 45 minutes without a move. So you've already talked about the position. You've already analyzed what you want to analyze. So how do you actually fill in what is, you know, considered dead time, right? And so I actually find classical and very quick chess, they're challenges in totally different ways. That doesn't necessarily make one all that much more enjoyable than the other. I like them for different reasons, truly. But I think that bullet chess is just, it's chaos. It's pandemonium. You just try to enjoy it while it's flying in front of you. And then classical chess, because it takes so long, you want to keep people interested without being repetitive. And that's quite hard in its own right.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, do you see as the ideal format? One commentator, two, three, what works best? And what kind of division of tasks?
Ooh, good question. You're asking the questions I didn't expect and the hard-hitting ones. I typically like a two-person commentary team. It depends on the event, of course. But I think going solo, I did this the other day for 5 hours in speed chess. It's really hard. It's exhausting. Yeah. And you're sort of talking into a monitor. And for some people, they love streaming. I don't really stream so much anymore. I find it a bit challenging. But I think having a co-commentator is always great. When you get to three total people, it can be challenging not to step on each other's toes. And it has nothing to do with who the other commentators are. They could be my favorite people on the planet. But you're just sort of fighting for space a little bit. And how I see my role in the division of labor is I want to take the back seat. If people are thrilled that Judit Polgár was an amazing commentator that day, I did a great job. Like that is how I see my role. And during the candidates, that was another fun event. Like, how could I forget? I was commentating with Judit and David Howell and Peter Licko and Daniel Naroditsky and Anish Giri. You name these top players, these just luminaries of the game. Yeah. I get to commentate with these people, and that's an honor that I don't take lightly. And I really mean this, that if the, you know, social media, which I don't go on very often, if social media is going crazy on Twitter or X and Reddit, and they're saying, Judit is my favorite commentator, I actually say, you know what? That was a job well done. Like, that is what I want. I don't need to be the person that people are complimenting, truly. And I think that when it comes to division of roles, I'm always happy to take that backseat to make sure that the show is as great as possible. And what's great about shows is when people are happy with even one of the commentators, that's the sign that things are probably going right. If it's memorable enough that people are having a whole forum about it, two thumbs up from me, I'm happy. And that means hopefully you're going to stick around the next time and continue listening and learning.
Yeah. Well, you've seen revolutionary developments in the past couple of years. Chess has, well, really changed and is still changing. What course do you think it will, in which direction will it go?
Oh, you are really getting me with the difficult questions today. I think chess will get faster paced. I think that's just how society at large is things are getting shorter quicker. There will be room for classical chess. I think that, you know, the tales of its demise are greatly overstated, right? I think that classical chess does have a place, but I think even top players, because of the amount of opening preparation and, you know, theory and the amount of draws that peter out, I do think that, you know, it has a toll on the top players. I don't want to pretend like it doesn't, but I do love classical chess as well. I mean, I grew up playing it. That's how I learned the game. I mean, we talk back to Miron and his coaching. I would sit on my hands. That's what I learned to do when I was a child, is I would sit on my hands. So unlike some of the other youngsters I was playing against, I would have to patiently think, because in the back of my head, oh, Miron or my parents were out there somewhere where, you know, I need to take my time before moving. So I do think classical chess has its place. I think for me, you know, I've always told even the best players in the world this, that you want more fans, you want more people to watch, but realistically, new players are not just going to sit for a 7-hour show. That's just not how life works, right? If you don't know basketball, You probably aren't going to just sit in for a full game of basketball unless you're there in person. So I do think that, you know, highlight reel packages are a great addition to chess, just being able to boil things down into a shorter time frame. But I'm not saying that to remove classical chess forever. I'm saying so that people can learn, they can grow, they can start appreciating, hey, I want to sit through a longer game because I feel that intensity, because I played myself and I know what it's like to sit on a decision for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and et cetera. And I think that you can't just expect people to suddenly watch 7 hour games of chess. It's just not what people do, just like you wouldn't do that in another discipline. So I think that in some ways, chess needs to get faster to get slower. That may be a controversial take. It may be an incorrect take. I'm willing to be wrong. That's my rule number one of commentating, by the way, is a willingness to be incorrect, because just like the top players don't match the engine, I'm not going to be able to match the engine. Otherwise, I'd be playing in those tournaments and beating them all. So my point is that I think that we just need to keep building the audience in a healthy, respectful way to the traditions of the game, but being willing to open ourselves up to new audiences, to new players of different backgrounds, because ultimately what we want, what everyone wants, and I truly believe this, is for chess to be appreciated. And your bullet chess is a little bit too fast, as we're talking about. Speed chess is what most people play. It's what most people have time for. But I think that there will be some happy mediums. And it's really, you know, not only about what the fans want, but the fans, they have their say. And I think that quicker time controls are what the fans often most appreciate and often what they can get into. And that's not to take away from the long-term fans who want the classical chess. Because as I said, one of my favorite shows to commentate, Tata Steel, Viking Zay. I love it. I love the fighting chess. I love trying to translate it all for everybody. So I know people feel like this is a polarized conversation. And for me, it's not. It's about what ultimately gets people to watch all forms of chess in the biggest numbers and in the most entertaining but also educational ways. So I'm not taking a side. I just want more people to watch. And I think the quicker time controls do tend to get more people, with the exception being the World Championship, which we'll have later this year.
Absolutely. Well, and I think that there's still plenty of room for, well, for various developments. I suddenly remember a conversation we had maybe 10 years ago when you were still involved in sports statistics, and where we both agreed that this was highly underdeveloped in the chess world. And I think it still is.
It definitely still is, because there's so much data. Like, when I think about chess, there are so many things that we could just come up with on the fly for different stats. Like, how do you perform? How accurate are you when you have less than 10 minutes on your clock?
Yeah.
When you have less than 20, right? You can actually do this incrementally with different allotments of time. When you spend 30 plus minutes, how accurate is that decision? Are you actually less accurate than when you spend 15 minutes? So there's so many things that we can do that I think make the game more approachable, because as I mentioned, when it comes to the World Championship, what's so difficult is someone might not move for 45 minutes. And then you're just, what people are watching people sit down and doing nothing. That's the problem with chess. Let's be honest, that when people are playing chess, nothing is happening. There's silence. There's no movement. That's not typically what people try to watch. But if we could continue injecting more and more data into the game, and there are many people, you know, all across the chess world who are pulling up stats, bringing up numbers, it makes it so much more fun. Because people love fantasy sports, and there might be a world of fantasy chess. I know Magnus has ideas in that department. But just as a fan, to be able to see numbers, see data, and then wonder, wait, how do I do when I spend more time versus less time? Am I doing this correctly? Like, I think people want to be able to apply things to themselves, and data is a good way of helping them do that.
Yeah. Well, and there's so many developments that we see now that could very difficult, well, could not have been predicted, let's say, 10 years ago. What are the things that surprised you in a positive manner the most? Things that, new developments that you hadn't foreseen, and you suddenly realize, I like this, and I never could have imagined this.
You're asking some great questions, and no surprise, given the journalist that you are, but I think, what do I like of the change? I think the more engaging, talkative nature of chess, because I did grow up in the silent era, right? Just most of us, where chess was played in silence. And I have to say, that giving chess players the stage to showcase their personalities, whether it's Anish on Twitter, whether it's Hikaru streaming, whether it's Fabi podcasting, Magnus doing all of his many ventures, I think it's great, right? Mm-hmm. We see it of players not just at the highest levels of the game in terms of the top handful of people. I have to say that watching Pia Kremling analyze her daughter Anna's games, that's an absolute delight.
Yeah.
Can we just applaud Pia Kremling for a moment here? She is not only a legend at the board, but she has the endurance to commentate with excitement, with emotional attachment to each and every decision that her daughter is playing. That is so cool. Yeah. And the child version of me could never have envisioned that. But I do want to shout out Pia's, you know, forever, through over rooftops and into the wild, because I do believe that Pia is one of the best voices in the chess world. She is a professional player. She is true to her craft, but she's also willing to branch out, help her child. And, you know, this is going full circle, talking about families and caring for each other. But just to see that, like, that's true love on display. And it's love for her daughter. It's love for chess. It's love. And I think that, not to get too sappy here, it just makes me so happy seeing that unfold. So to the Kremling family, and of course the Juan as well. I mean, it just, that is something I never would have thought of, because the Polgar sisters, who are amazing, right? They're like in psychology books, and that's sort of what it felt like. It's like, you don't just have to be in a textbook, and the Polgar sisters are not, credit to them. They're exceptional players. They're exceptional ambassadors of the game, but like, that's what it felt like. So to see the change from textbook examples to this person is just speaking on the fly and telling us their thoughts, I think that's really cool, because what chess can offer in a way that even most in all physical sports can't is the thought process behind each and every decision. Mm-hmm. Right? If you could hear LeBron James talk about why he took a dribble with his left hand, then switch it to his right, and then why he passed it instead of continue dribbling, that's cool. Like, people want to learn from the best. Yeah. If we could learn from Messi as he is just zooming past players and he, you know, there's a quick little instep with the right foot, like, that's cool. Like, I would love to learn how the top players do what they do. Chess offers that. So as slow as the World Championship may be, as, you know, inactive as it may seem when players are sitting there, it offers a play-by-play thorough analysis of trains of thought and decision-making. And to me, that's cool. And we are watching that in real time with some of these top streamers and content creators.
I couldn't agree more, Robert. And I think it's amazing the kind of comments from players and the insights that we're getting these days that we couldn't have dreamt of. And what I think is the great thing that, let's say, when players do that, we would love to hear Messi explain why he's making this move. But of course, football has been professionalized to such an extent that it would always be scripted, and chances that we would get the real truth would be very slim. But in chess, I mean, we hear Hikaru, we hear Magnus, we hear Pia, and we know this is true. I mean, this is what they're really thinking. They're not making this up. And I think that really is a treat. And I think it's great that you point that out. Well, maybe we should stop here, because this sounds like a perfect end of a very positive and pleasant conversation, Robert. Very well, thank you very much for all the insights and the background to Miron Scheer's book. I think it's wonderful that the book is there, and that there is this tribute to his unique personality and his training method. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me on. And if I can, Dirk-Jan, just say thank you to you. I mean, we've known each other for so long and always appreciate the conversation. And I do want to give one last, you know, big thank you to Miron for all that he's done for my life, all that he's done for my chess. And I mean it when I say, when I first got this book in my hands, I cried. I mean, it's just a lifetime of hard work from somebody who meant so much to me. And yeah, the book is just, most importantly, it just cements his legacy in physical form in a way that I know was important to him and his family. And I'm so appreciative to New and Chess for publishing it, because it's a great book. You know, I'm not trying to pitch that, but I think that it just means so much on a personal level to his family, to him, and to me. So I just love that it's in book form. I'm just thrilled to have it, and I hope everyone enjoys it.
Very little to add to that, Robert. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If you're interested in Miron Cher's book Dream Moves, we have an attractive offer for you. If you use the code DREAM20 in our webshop, you get a 20% discount on the book or the ebook. DREAM20, that's DREAM20, 5 letters and 2 numbers as 1 word. You can also find the code in the description of this podcast on our website, newinchess.com. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.